Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hello, and welcome to Mapping the College Audition, a podcast where we explore the landscape of the college theater world and try to demystify this daunting audition process. I'm your host, Charlie Murphy, director of MTCA, that's Musical Theater College Auditions, and today we have got an EGOT-nominatable show lined up for you. Brandon Victor Dixon is on the show to share some great wisdom and insight from his years in the business as both an actor and a producer. We talk about his exciting career and some good stuff on the nature of art and commerce and advocacy. You may notice on this episode that your very own favorite podcast host was playing injured for this interview. This was right in the middle of a really rough two-week stint for me where I basically caught back-to-back diseases. I had like a really tough stomach flu, and then basically as soon as I got better from that, I caught hand-foot-mouth from my daughter, who has now brought this disease home. I don't know if you've heard of this disease, hand-foot-mouth. It happens in daycares for the third time this season. Just wild. And sadly, that second week was also in conjunction with Elizabeth being away doing a concert. So it was a very tough week for your favorite podcast host. He appreciates the sympathies that you're all sending his way. I don't know why he's talking in the third person, but that's what he's doing. For those of our current seniors out there who are about to do New York City Unifieds, I'm just going to say, let this story be a little bit of precaution. Please be careful out there. Our pediatrician said this is the worst winter for like normal diseases that she's ever seen. Even if you're not particularly COVID nervous, maybe you're many times boosted and you've had it recently, so you're not going to ask, who cares about the disease? I think it still might be a good time to practice some just good general virus hygiene with masking and hand washing. You know, make sure also that you're keeping your immune system up with sleep and, you know, good nutrition and exercise and all those kind of things. Whatever you can do to try to keep yourself healthy and not go through the 2 weeks that I've just gone through. And of course, that goes for all of our listeners out there, not just the ones who are about to audition for New York City Unifieds, but, you know, of course, I know many of our seniors have this upcoming audition as well. Just a little friendly PSA from your MTCA coach. But on our end, we're all recovering. We're thinking healthy thoughts. We're trying to plow forward with a productive 2023. And I'm wishing the same to all of you. And with that, let's jump into this episode with the wonderful Brandon Victor Dixon. Well, we are honored to be joined by Brandon Victor Dixon today. Brandon is an actor and a producer and an advocate. He's a graduate of Columbia University, where he has a BA in theater. He's been on Broadway in shows like The Color Purple, where he's nominated for a Tony, Motown, where he got a Grammy nomination, Shuffle along with MTCA director Leo Ash Evans, in Hamilton, where he replaced Leslie Odom, The Scottsboro Boys, where he got 100 different nominations. He's been on TV in like Jesus Christ Superstar, Live in Concert, where he played Judas to the great John Legend. He's also can be seen in Modern Love and Power. And as a producer, his company, Walk, Run, Fly, has produced multiple works, including the Tony Award-winning Hedwig and the Angry Inch. As an advocate, he is the co-founder of the We Are Foundation, which is a nonprofit turning art into action. Brandon, welcome to the show. How are you feeling today?
I'm well, thank you. Happy to be here.
I am so excited to talk to you. And I'm going to start you off with the same question I ask most of our guests, which is just to start us off, if you can, thinking back to 16, 17-year-old Brandon. Sort of what was your mission statement, or if you were precocious enough to have one of those, or what was your sort of plan with college and how you saw yourself getting into this industry back then?
You know, my plan was very practical. I was very fortunate. I knew from a young age that this is what I wanted to do. And my initial focus was Broadway. So, you know, when deciding about college, I knew I decided I needed to be either in Los Angeles or in New York or maybe Chicago because of their, you know, their theater mm-hmm. market. And I decided on New York. And really it was about being in the place where the art I wanted to professionally be a part of was being created and making sure that I could go to school in an environment where I could be auditioning mm-hmm. And trying to break into the industry while I was in school, because I didn't want to graduate and then have to be juggling, figuring out how to maintain living a life while also having time to audition and learn how to audition and figure out how to become a professional and then get into a professional company. So that's why I wanted to be in New York and be kind of engaging in my professional education while I was engaging in my mm-hmm. my general education.
And skill set wise, so did you know musical theater from the jump, that musical theater was a goal?
Theater, you know, theater, yeah. But in my education, I had done a lot of musicals, so I was familiar with how it worked, the sensibility, and I had a great appreciation for acting acting and performance in musicals, because my primary education was Shakespeare mm-hmm. and musicals. And so, you know, that's where I operated primarily.
And, you know, with choosing a BA and obviously a very academic BA, was there any consciousness to, like, what we'll talk about in the later half of the show a little bit more, the producing and the advocacy? Was there any consciousness of, like, what you might want to do in theater other than being an actor in your education?
No, with the educational component, I ended up as a theater major, but I started as an econ major. I was an econ mm-hmm. major with a film minor. So the thing for me I applied to Juilliard and to Columbia, but I applied to Columbia early. And so when I was accepted to Columbia a week before my audition to Juilliard. Hmm. So I canceled my audition and I went to Columbia because for me, I wanted to go to a liberal arts institution as opposed to a conservatory because mm-hmm. One, I had interests outside of just the theater arts, and also I understood as an actor and as a performer, we are conduits, we are vessels, and we are channeling and synthesizing information, different information and different experiences. So the broader my education, the more people, the different kinds of people who are interested in different kinds of things that I interact with and that I get to know, the greater the reservoir of information and energy I get to siphon into my artistic resource, my artistic tool, mm-hmm. and the more depth I have as a performer and as an actor. So that's why I did that. And I was an econ major initially, just to give me a film major to give me another set of skills and to introduce me to another genre of art. But all the while I was taking classes in the theater department mm-hmm. and I was performing in productions on campus. So I was continuing my theater education. It just was not the focus of my degree. And what ended up happening is that I left school, and then I left school after my first semester senior year to go mm-hmm. join the company of the Lion King. Mm-hmm. And when I returned to the city to finish my degree, I did not want to go back into calculus. So I let go of my econ. I let go of my econ major. And I had amassed 96% of the theater credits through my general study. Uh-huh. So I just pivoted to the theater degree because it was the easiest thing for me to finish out my full degree in one semester.
And so how does Lion King happen? Are you just auditioning with everyone else? I mean, did you have an agent at that point? How did you find your way to the national tour from college?
So the summer of during my freshman year, I had auditioned for an a cappella group on campus. And I didn't end up joining the group, but one of the members who was in it was a woman named Donna Vivino. She was the original Cosette, young Cosette in Les Miserables. And she was like, look, I bumped into her one night on campus. She was like, if you're interested in doing this business, I really think you should. And I recommend you meet my manager. Mm-hmm. That summer, I met her manager and ended up, you know, I auditioned for her and ended up signing with her. And from that point on, the summer after my freshman year, I started auditioning throughout the year. So I was going on auditions for, you know, my open calls to Rent and Lion King and all sorts of things, mm-hmm. non-equity tours of Ragtime. And so that's how I got a manager, not an agent, but my manager was able to get me the auditions, and that's how I booked Lion King.
Totally.
And so then, all right, so you take that national tour, you come back, you then finish school. Yeah. And then is it a pretty steady progress? Or are you one of those lucky people who basically are like, and then I did a Broadway show, and then I took a second off and another Broadway show? Were there some of those fallow periods down there where you're like, oh God, I'm not working? What is this?
Oh, there were definitely fallow periods. I mean, yeah. So I came back from Lion King. I finished school. But I also, I came back from Lion King and I booked The Color Purple. Mm-hmm. I booked it a couple, like a month or two after The Lion King, and started to do the out of town for that. Was on Broadway, did The Color Purple, you know, got nominated for a Tony. So, you know, things are like
24 at this point, 23,
24. Yeah, exactly. Woo. So, yeah, this is 2005, I'm 23, 24, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so things are kind of steadily progressing, certainly. And then, you know, I went from The Lion King, I booked the Ray Charles musical they were developing at that time. Mm-hmm. So I went out to Pasadena Playhouse in LA and started working on that, came back from that, and then started doing a Leap of Faith. So I got into this like reading workshop era.
So you can't talk to me about follow periods, then, Brent. Well, you're having too much good here. This is still too good. These are all
readings. These are workshops. Well, you have to remember, yeah, readings and workshops, whilst they're great because they expose you to new material and new people, they pay you $5.
That's true. That is so true.
You know, you have to be living in New York City while mm-hmm. you are not in a mainstream job, right? And what ended up happening is I was developing the Scottsboro Boys and the Ray Charles musical. We did the Scottsboro Boys off Broadway mm-hmm. 2009. Brilliant production, brilliant thing I got to be a part of. But then both the Scottsboro Boys and Ray Charles were coming to Broadway at the same time, and I had to pick between one. Oof. And because I had been developing Ray Charles for so long, uh-huh. and I was a part of the team over here. They had kind of welcomed me into the creative team. I chose Ray Charles. Mm-hmm. And then the investors for Ray Charles, their businesses went under in 2008, mm-hmm. the financial crisis. So that show never went to Broadway. And Scottsboro Boys did, and I didn't get to go with it. So I was in this place where I had two Broadway shows, and then I had none. Uh-huh. And the one I gave up got to go on without me. The actor who replaced me got nominated for a Tony Award. Ooh. And I was just in this place of, and I had been nominated for that. I mean, people would say it's one of my greatest performances ever.
Yep. I've been nominated. I see Olivier, I see Drama Desk, I see Lucy Lortel, Outer Critics Circle. You got a bunch, yeah.
So to not do it and then to see it go, I mean, the show had challenges on Broadway, but the actor got nominated. And I love the actor. He's a good friend of mine. We've shared roles and done things before. But that was a challenging period for me because also, it felt like things had been aligned. I'd been making decisions according to a philosophy of life, and things were moving. And mm-hmm. and then I made a decision, and things were falling apart. And then mm-hmm. I was in that period for a couple of years, you know, between 2009 and 2014, really, of not being sure what was next or how to kind of get back on track.
And are you doing any? Are you waiting tables? Are you doing any survival jobs? Or are you mostly still like, well, I'm still working.
No, I'm, you know, because like I was very careful to make sure that my overhead in New York City was low. I was
living econ in major. It's an econ major in you. You had it.
Yes, I mean, I was living in a studio. My rent was no more than $1,000 a month. Like mm-hmm. I was very much trying. And this is even like because I at this point I've done Lion King, I've done Color Purple on Broadway. Like mm-hmm. so, I've had periods that have been flush. But I did not expand a great deal of mm-hmm. my overhead, you know, during those periods. I held on to it because I, you know, just to be safe, to be self, be conscious of and responsible about money. And so I didn't have to do a lot of that, but I did do some of it, you know, throughout these periods. One of the jobs that I would do, because the thing that's tricky is if you have a job that occupies too much of your time, you're not available for auditions mm-hmm. or you can't go do the, so I was a referee for adult intramural sports league here in the city of Zog.
Brandon, how did I not run into you? Zog Sports, I used to play. I'm like, come on.
So yeah, I was a dodgeball referee. I was a soccer mm-hmm. referee. So, you know, I would do things like that. And every now and again, maybe I'm a private gig here or there. I could go through, do things like that. Slide in a bartend here or there, but those mm-hmm. are the kinds of things I would do as survival jobs and make sure I picked up enough work that I could keep on unemployment stuff like that. Uh-huh.
But consciously really trying to keep your overhead low so you're available. So you're not
because particularly in the early on, it's just like, you know, you things can be inconsistent. And I never wanted to be in a position where I had to take an artistic job that I was not connected to or inspired by. I'd rather do a regular job than take an artistic job that does not inspire me.
Totally agree with that. I'd love to talk a little bit about, you know, you had such a breadth of a career. I mean, of course, it helps that you booked so big so early. But you've really, it seems like, got to participate in a bunch of different kinds of shows and experiences. You know, I know a little bit from Leo about like Shuffle Along and some of the craziness of the getting new pages and constant changes and that kind of stuff versus like a Hamilton, which I imagine you're stepping into a machine that runs beautifully and works and smoothly. Is there, you know, did you really enjoy sort of new work? Did you enjoy the sort of originating Broadway things? Like what was the most exciting artistically to work on?
New work is always the most exciting thing for me to work on. Excuse me. Generally speaking, that's, I'm only looking to do new work and to originate things. I'm rarely inclined to return to a role I've done before, and I'm rarely inclined to replace. In fact, I turned Hamilton down 3 times before I accepted
it. And was it just the Brinks truck that got you, or what made you decide I am going to end up doing that?
The Brinks truck certainly helped. The Brinks truck certainly helped nudge my agents to be like, I need you to think about this. Okay. Yeah. So, but I also had friends in the industry that were like, you should do this. So,
it's a hell of a role. I'm
so grateful that I did it.
You replaced Leslie Odom as Burr on Broadway for those who are not following. Yeah.
And I'm so grateful that I did it. I had a wonderful time, and it was a wonderful growth experience as an artist, because the playing field that Lynn and Lacamoire created is just highly fertile. You know, as an actor, there's a lot of material to pull from and to create your own unique version of a thing. So yes, that was really wonderful.
Were there anything fun Hamilton stories or anything of like the experience of what it was to step into those shoes?
I mean, look, I think a creation that came out of Hamilton that kind of still exists today. Like, I started a thing. It's not as prominent anymore as it was then. But I started a thing called Burr's Corner when I was doing Hamilton, because I knew how much of a phenomenon it was and how well people knew the show. So when I got into the show, and Hamilton's the kind of show, like, it's set to a clip track. So, like, there's no missing an entrance and the orchestra catches up with you. Or there's if you make a mistake, it's gone. It's over. There's no fixing
it. The train is leaving the station. That's it.
And I knew in this show more than any other show, because the album had been out already for years, like, if I make a mistake, people are going to know immediately that I messed up. So I would regularly, as soon as I messed something up, I would run off stage and I would get on my IG and I'd be like, okay, Burr's Corner, which is like Winnie the Pooh's Corner, Pooh's Corner. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, Burr's Corner. All right. I was supposed to say this, but instead I said, I don't know what happened. But all right, I own it. We'll fix it tomorrow.
It feels a little like Shakespeare in that way of like, you know, you could turn and like half the crowd is like, I know, I could finish this speech. I could finish to be or not to be. I'm like, you could finish this for me, couldn't you? Yeah.
But like, I just started doing it on Broadway. It's fun.
What about that Pence moment? I was only in researching this, I was remembering, oh my God, that was you who, that like, for those who remember that like viral moment, where like when Pence comes to see the show, this is right after the election, and like you read this little speech to him. It just occurred to me, in looking back, of like Pence did have this weird moment of patriotism over party or whatever.
I don't know if I can call that patriotism over party.
I mean, he had a moment of reason over I don't know, insanity maybe.
Spent the night in the theater.
But I'm saying, is it from the night in the theater? Do you give yourself credit for it? That's what I want to know. I'm like, not unlike a Jefferson or Hamilton choosing Jefferson over Burr or something.
You know, that incident was very interesting, and all and everything that followed it, I think, was very interesting as well. I mean, it's one of those things. I think it just it highlights an interesting contradictory nature of some of us as Americans, or as human beings, to you know, denounce the lifestyle or the existence of our fellow citizens, while also, you know, full-heartedly wanting to desire and participate in sharing artistic experiences with them and sharing artistic experiences that they are creating for community. It's just, it's an odd, you know, mental dichotomy, social dissonance that we have as a society sometimes.
And was that like, I mean, I know that was viral for on talk shows or whatever, a few days or whatever. Was that a moment where like you're getting recognized by people who aren't even theater fans or people like, oh my God, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, at least I have found in general that yes, people recognize me from that. So I get recognized from shows and I get recognized from that incident.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine this a little bit from NBC's Jesus Christ Superstar must have been a big moment in your career where people are seeing you who maybe aren't always Broadway fans, aren't always coming to New York, et cetera. Was that a, in terms of the way you approach that material and talking about the different breadth of your career, you know, was it anything different to that experience being filmed and or maybe being different because it's filled with literal pop stars as opposed to necessarily theater people? Did you feel like that the way you approached that work changed at all?
Not really, because they really designed it theatrically and they designed the process theatrically as well, like a mm-hmm. live production. So, but I think it did, because you're not, with Broadway shows, you're really working your way into it, working your way up to it. You're mm-hmm. 6 weeks of rehearsal, and then there's the 4 weeks of previews. You're still working things out. You're sorting out your character. You're working the vocals into your voice. And then you're into the run. And before any, the only really like substantial markers you have in your run are opening when you get reviews and then leading up to awards season, mm-hmm. you know? So those are the when people are evaluating, you see. But in one of these live performances, it's just that live performance. And so you need to be ready by then. It's not, mm-hmm. you don't get a runway after opening night to kind of continue to be ready and get ready. You've got to be ready by then. So it changes the vocal conditioning of vocal preparation uh-huh. a little bit and the level at which you need to be at by opening. But for the most part, it's largely structured like a theatrical development process. Mm-hmm.
And you guys were not the production where they like aired the tech rehearsal, were you?
No, that was my next. My next production. But uh-huh. to be perfectly fair, what they do is most of the time on these live musicals on TV, what they'll do is they will do a full performance on Saturday uh-huh. and they will tape that. So it's live and the audience is there and they'll tape that. And then they will do the live one on Sunday for the East Coast audience. Uh-huh. And then they will comp what goes out everywhere else. Uh-huh. So only the East Coast is getting an actual live feed. Uh-huh. Everybody else is getting a comp performance from the night before and the live feed.
I love it. All right, let's take a short break. And on the back end, we're going to talk a little bit about producing and advocacy as well.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
All right, we are back with Brandon Victor Dixon. And I want to talk a little bit about producing. So how did this all start? I'd love to hear about the founding of Walk, Run, Fly, which is your production company. But I'd also maybe love to hear a little bit about like how do you define theatrical producing or what your role is as a theatrical producer?
For me, the producing came as a natural extension of doing shows. I've luckily been fortunate enough to originate a number of shows. So I've been able to bear close witness to the process of what it takes to create and build a dynamic and successful Broadway show. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, as I've kind of grown in my art. You know, you start out wanting to learn how to command your words and your notes, and then you want to command the scene and the song, and then you want to command the character, and then you want command over the message of the show and how you all are operating at large. And so, you know, you're the depth at which you understand and want to implement your art just kind of grows as you grow and expand. And so as you're trying to think about each piece, you need to be plugged into the process in a different way. Cause now I'm thinking about, well, I want the piece to do this. I want the song and I want the scene to do this. Well, then I want, what if the lights could hit me here? Or what if I could levitate? What if I could, well, that will cost X and that will cost this. And all right, I got to convince the director to let me do, and I got to convince the. So then it became a point of, all right, how do I make myself an official part of these process so that I'm not having to manipulate or finagle my way, that I can have a voice at the table and I can say, this is what I think we should do and why I think we should do it. Mm-hmm. And not only that, so that after, you know, 2-3 months of putting your creative material into a show, integrating your own creative material into a show, and then performing it for a year, and then you leave and you're no longer getting paid by that creative material, but that show is continuing to generate money for years and years. Mm-hmm. You want to be a part of that. So, but producing was both about wanting to have greater influence over the projects I was a part of, creative influence, but also wanting to be able to benefit from the value of those things when that creativity is able to have success. But also, you know, I very early on in my career have been able to be part of projects and walk into rooms that are rare, and I'm very fortunate in that way. And not all of my, you know, colleagues and peers have the kind of access that I have, but they're exceptionally talented people, just as talented as I am. A lot of them are writers and creators. And so I wanted to be able to help provide those opportunities for them as well. So that's, you know, that's the main impetus behind, you know, taking on my initial producing partner. You know, I brought him on because I believed in his talent, and I wanted to connect him to the producers, the theater owners, the creatives that I was working with. And, you know, I wanted to give him the opportunity to show what he could do, you know. And now that I'm working on my own, I continue that philosophy. I continue to try and push that philosophy forward.
And when you said, I love, you said, I can bear witness. Was there a conscious effort of like getting into rooms that actors don't always get into? How did you bear witness of some of those higher level conversations?
You know, for me, there was not a conscious effort or awareness to do it. It's something I found was happening as a result of the kinds of creative rooms I was in and the kinds of creative partners that I was in. It's about how they welcomed me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about how people like Aubrey Lynch and Jeff Lee, who were the supervisors of The Lion King at the time, it was about how they took care of me and nurtured me through what was a very challenging process of The Lion King. I shouldn't have booked the show. And I, you know, it's almost a miracle that I survived the job in many ways, shape, or form, you know. People like Scott Sanders, the producer of The Color Purple, and Ali Willis, and Stephen Bray, and Brenda Russell, who wrote it, they were very collaborative artists. They understood, they gathered a group of artists and performers whose expertise they knew had value in the creation of their project. When we went out of town for The Color Purple, Marsha Norman, the book writer, threw out Act Two. And she rewrote an entire Act Two based on what we were all doing in the room there. They just really welcomed me into the process. And so as I continue to move forward, the Scottsboro Boys, John Kander and Susan Stroman and Tommy Thompson, it's like they welcomed us into the process as creative collaborators. And so it's that level of inclusion, which does not always happen. Creative teams are not always like that. Mm-hmm. It's that level of welcoming and collaboration. And then appreciation for the kindness and the grace and generosity I think I try to bring into creative spaces that make people want to have you around, want to work with you more, make people open the door to you when you come to them and they say, I know you only know me as an actor, but I have a production company now, I want to produce work, and it's how you operate as a human being in these other spaces. It's the generosity with which you operate that then will create the space for these people to say, you know, I don't know you in that capacity, but I'm willing to let you come into the door and talk to me about your idea. Oh, I heard you want to produce. Meet this person. Jeffrey Seller, the producer of Hamilton, was the first person to call me when he heard I'd become a producer. And he's like, talk to me about what you're doing. I like that project. How can I help you? Here's my general manager, Andy Jones. Like, talk to him about. And so that it's that level of kind of operating as how I've looked at it.
So cool. And just to, for a like baseline definition for maybe some of our parents or and students who are not as familiar with what a producer, what a production company does, what is that role as opposed to a director, as opposed to a different leadership of a theatrical production?
A producer can be very broadly defined. I think at its heart, the producer is the person responsible for the financial and administrative running of the production. So the producer is the person who's going to make sure the money comes in, whether it's their money or not. They're going to manage that money. They're going to put together, they're going to choose the director and the writer, and they're going to put together the general manager and the marketing department. And these are the pieces that are going to make the show run. So maybe a writer comes to a producer and says, hey, I have a project I want to do, and may pitch it to them. The producer's like, okay, great. Who do we need to write the music, or who do we want to direct it, or what? And so, like, the producer will create great options for you, put together a creative team. Okay, what's our first step? We need a reading. We just need to do it on a table. We'll do it in my living room. Okay, now we need an official equity 29-hour reading. All right, well, I'm going to go gather two or three investors. They're going to come to this table read in the living room. Now that they're inspired, they're going to put up the money. And now we're going to do an official reading. It's going to cost us $30,000. And we've got 5-10 people in the room. Now I've got to secure the rights to the other music that we want. But you see, the producer is the person who has to really put together all the kind of minutiae, the little pieces, and create the space for the creatives to do their work.
And was there anything, I mean, you mentioned the econ or the plan econ major. Was there anything sort of skill set wise you felt like you didn't have at where you started that you're like, I really need to learn this? Or was it all stuff that you're like, I can figure out how to do this. I'm already equipped to do the sort of production end of things.
Oh, no, certainly. There was a lot that I've had to learn, and I'm continuing to learn. And there are various ways to do it. You know, a lot of times I take meetings with producers who I've worked with, and I'm like, this is what I'm getting into. Can you explain to me how this aspect of profit sharing works? Uh-huh. How does the investment share work? How's the model work here? Okay, what if I do this? What can I offer X? Like, part of it has been about you can't be afraid to ask questions, and it can be challenging. When you move into a new space, it can be really challenging because you have to ask questions to learn. But obviously, if you have new ideas and new projects and you're asking people for money and things, then you don't want to ask questions because you don't want these people to think you don't know what you're doing.
Give me a lot of money. Also, what should I do with the money?
Exactly. So, you know, and for me, I have not done as much of these things as I try to encourage myself to do now. So when I talk to young people, I try to encourage them to do them sooner than I did. Mm-hmm. You know, embrace failure, embrace risk, embrace chaos. And hurl yourself into trying to do the things now, because you have time to do a thing and fail. You have time to do a thing and succeed at it for a little while and then decide you don't like it and then abandon it completely and re-educate yourself entirely into a whole new thing. You know, your 20s, your 30s, it's such a lot of time. And a lot of times we are careful, we're overly careful because we don't want to make mistakes. We don't want to miss X or miss Y. And so we won't do this or we won't do that, or we'll hedge our bets or we'll half do it. And you need to hurl yourself into the experience because there's time to make another choice if you decide you want to make another choice.
So true. What about, you know, when you're producing something, let's say Hedwig, which was so successful, like, do you ever feel like a jealousy of the other half of your career? Like, do you ever feel like, hey, this is so great that the producing's going so well. What about me as an actor? I want to be stepping forward into that. Like, do you feel like how do they balance each other out, the two hyphens of producing and acting? And or does one ever feel like it's taking from the other?
That's a good question. I have felt that I have had too big a focus on the producing over the last couple of years.
Oh no, this was not a note from me. Let's be clear. I wasn't being like, you need to get back on stage, buddy.
No, but what I'm saying is those thoughts, we do have those thoughts. Now, I've tried to make sure that the producing work is well integrated with the acting work. You know, I try to so that the strengths can strengthen each other. But you know, I have found for myself, I was like, you know, I have found that I put too much energy into the producing side of things, and I've needed to recalibrate and put more energy back into the acting side of things, particularly because my career is very much in development still. Like, sure. I'm still growing and building, and my producing success is as a result of the strength of what I have built as an actor. That's me. That's my currency. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I always have to remember that that is the engine, that is the fuel for the producing efforts. And so that has to be primary.
And what does that mean? Because I love that. We talked to many artists who are kind of multi-hyphenates in different ways. They do what they write or produce or do other things. What does it mean when you say, hey, I got to put more energy toward acting? Like, what is that? How does that shift in your daily life as you go, I'm gonna shift some resources? Or how do you sort of make an adjustment like that if you feel like one is getting too much attention?
Part of it is an internal pivot. Part of it is just recognizing, okay, you have been focusing on your other partners in your producing world and your partner's projects and making sure this happens here and this goes there and not putting as much focus on, you know, making that audition and hitting that audition and mm-hmm. meeting that casting director and showing up at that premiere for your, you know, for your acting. And I began to recognize this, like, I have more traction mm-hmm. I have more traction in the producing when I'm focused mm-hmm. on the acting, because they're excited about me as an actor. They appreciate what I can do as a producer, but the excitement is the actor, and that creates the other opportunity. So sometimes it becomes an internal pivot. And for me, it's like, if I started, you start the new thing, producing the production company. And so then you start looking for projects and partners and you focus on building those things. And producing is a long road. So it's a long period of development and finding the resources and making sure you can get there. And what you'll find is that as you continue to chase that project, you maybe leave the acting a little bit behind, or you only sees what comes to you as opposed to going towards certain things.
I was going to say the same thing. It feels like there's something about acting that often, you know, what people aren't normally going to turn down an amazing audition or that kind of thing that's coming to them, but often the things that you have to come to, that where you have to go, I could go to this opening night or not. I could practice my singing. I could, you know, things that are a little softer as opposed to like my email inbox, which says I need to answer this thing for a production. Someone owes me this, or I owe them this, or, you know, some of those harder sort of life things. I'd love to talk a little bit about your role as an advocate. Again, not to make you just do tons of definitions, but maybe I'd love to define, at least from your perspective, what advocating means, what it is means to be an advocate, and maybe specifically that the We Are Foundation, or the founding of We Are.
I think to advocate means to live in the world with grace and empathy, and to stand up for those who need support in their fight mm-hmm. for enfranchisement, for independence, for social acceptance, for personal confidence, whomever they are, wherever they are in their journey in life, in their search for who they are versus what they were told they were when they came into this world. You know, I think mm-hmm. that's what advocacy is really about. For me, the We Are Foundation is a vehicle. Art for me is the most exponentially transformative force in this world. You know, a poem, a song, a play can change a person's perspective in a moment. And so, you know, the We Are Foundation works to use the power of art to bridge the gaps between communities by turning art into action. And so, and that can manifest in different ways. We came into existence during the last general election to really work in lower income communities, to connect them to local election issues, local electoral politics, and, you know, really just the energy connection of what are the challenges in my life, in my neighborhood, and how can I connect them to a functional element in the system before mm-hmm. me. So that's really what that's about. But for me, you know, advocacy is just a very human, role that, we all must play. And that's a lot of what my art is about. A lot of the artistic projects I choose to engage in are about humanity and about bringing us closer together as human beings and helping us, really, reach a greater level of connected human consciousness.
And where does the art come in? So in terms of like the election work that you were doing around the most recent election, how are you advocating through art? I mean, are the students producing art? Are they seeing art? Or how is the art wrapped up in the advocacy?
It manifests in different ways, but a lot of it is actually working with local community groups that are arts-based. So like mm-hmm. in Detroit, we work at the Mosaic Youth Theater. And what we'll do with them is we'll talk to the young students about the issues that are going on in their community and talk to them about ways to affect change in those things. And then we'll create installations with different groups of local community groups that are events that bring people together to talk about the issues that are going on or to meet the local politicians so they can talk to them about what are going on in the local issues. So that's really kind of how we use it.
Yep. I mean, I think so many people, when they become actors or artists in general, but especially I think I know a lot of young actors say like, "How I want to change the world with my art. I want to make the kind of art that changes the world." How do you feel like in terms of like theater itself, that responsibility, or where do you feel like that responsibility lies, in terms of the shows that are produced in terms of the actors in their productions or in terms of the messages of the shows? I guess I'd love to hear about like, if you look at a Broadway or if you look at a commercial musical theater, like where are we seeing that successfully and unsuccessfully today?
I mean, you have to define success. I think a meaningful piece of art that is trying to say something positive, inject something positive into the world, you know, if it gets seen, that can be a level of success. You know, so many things get created and never get seen. It's hard to define what success is when you're talking about art, because inherently, the success of art is its impact on the human being. Right. Its impact on the individual. But for us, when we're talking about art, it's art and entertainment, right? Which means art as a business. So we're dealing with the intersection of art and economics, and they do not compute. And the more the economics becomes integrated with the art, the more the art becomes limited and the more the art has limited chances to exist, to sustain, to become a success, whether that's exposure to people or generate money. So I don't know. I suppose in this day and age, the most successful pieces are the ones that manage to spread social messages, but also manage to, achieve a level of economics that they can spread across the world. And people will continue to, some people would argue this, but I wouldn't. Argue against this, but I wouldn't. But, you know, Hamilton can be an example of that. It talks a lot about social issues within the context of history, within the context of who has power, what does power mean. Hamilton also manages to strip our founding fathers of the cultural mythology that we've endowed them with, and we get to see these people as human beings with flaws, but fighting for what they believe was right in the world, and kind of gets to show us as children, as regular human beings, that we too have the power to affect changes in our discourse and our democracy, to mold the kind of world and government that we want to operate in. It shows like this, A Strange Loop, which tells a very personal journey, but a very personal journey that involves a lot of social struggles that many individuals are dealing with today, not just about our sexuality, but how people see us in our sexuality, who we are, and how our dreams manifest through that. So, success is hard to define. But I definitely see producers out there looking to produce work that is about the human condition and that spreads messages that help give us insight into other worlds. The bands visit other cultures, but that resonate with our own.
Well, but you're talking about in the sort of dissonance, at least between like art and commerce, at least in the current Broadway structures of things. Like obviously Hamilton is incredibly successful financially, sort of successful in terms of basically always.
Rent was one of those. Socially meaningful, but incredibly economically successful.
Yep. And I think some would argue, though, that a show like Hamilton was not ideal in terms of its, I wouldn't necessarily make this argument, but not ideal in terms of its impact of, in some ways it does uphold supremacy in sort of the way that it.
And some people would argue against it. I was like, no, I'm not one of those people, because I see you can't do everything in every show. You can't say everything in every show. And you also can't say and do everything in the same way. Mm-hmm. So for me, Hamilton is subversive. Hamilton is an insurgent. Mm-hmm. And Hamilton, it creates a playing field to discuss a lot of things. Hamilton does not, it's not an encyclopedia. So yes, you can't just run into Hamilton and then walk away from there and say, that's American history. What you have to do is like, oh, this is interesting. I want to know more. And then when you do that, then you get into the details and you learn more about, you learn more about the Schuylers and how all their money is from slave owning. And you learn that Hamilton himself, you know, he engaged in the financial dealings of slave. And you get into this stuff, but the point is to have a window into it.
Yep.
And for me, Hamilton specifically strips away the veneration and the mythology so that we can look at the flaws of these people.
Well, and it is really difficult to make, you can make art in a basement that nobody wants to see that may be so incredibly politically accurate and so many have all the things you want, but then also to actually get those butts in seats. You know, it's always a miracle to get, you know, to make a Hamilton, to make something like that, that people want to see is its own, you know, artistic miracle. All right. Are we ready to play our special game? Our special game, this is built around the fact that, I don't know if you realize this, but you're an O away from an EGOT in a nominations. If we count nominations, that you're from an EGOT nom, you're one Oscar nomination away, right? So our special game here, we're going to try to pitch, I'm going to pitch you some different ideas to get you an Oscar nomination so that you can be an EGOT nom. Does that sound like it's going to be fun?
Sounds like it's going to be a great time.
We'll see what happens here. Okay. So what I tried to pick was some very easy to win categories or easy to be nominated categories, not as much popular categories here. Okay. And we're going to try to, I'm going to try to pitch you a best animated short film. Okay. So we're going to try to get an Oscar nomination, the best animated short film category. Here's my starting pitch. A kind of a Schoolhouse Rock situation, but it's for like baby boomers and it like explains TikTok. Does that make sense to us? So it's like, here's what I'm going to try to get you to produce for me. It's like a Schoolhouse Rock. It's going to have some, a little beat to it. It's going to have a little fun, but it's going to be all like, or it's like pronouns, things that like old people don't understand. And we're going to explain it Schoolhouse Rock style. Do you think we could get a best animated short film nomination?
I absolutely think that's doable. Absolutely. That's
all right. So now I'm going to throw them to you. I'm going to throw a couple ideas and we'll see what you can come up with now that's going to live in the, a best documentary short subject. What's like the best, what's something that's happened recently that we could come up with that's going to be, we're going to get a best documentary short subject that Oscar nomination.
Best documentary short subject. We would do a documentary short on the rise of Coleman Domingo.
Oh, okay.
Yes, from theater to film.
And do we have this cast?
We're going to do it kind of meta. So like, Coleman will be playing a version of Coleman.
Uh-huh. You know,
we'll do that. But then everybody else around him will be different.
Okay, great. We'll use like some age makeup or whatever. We'll use the technology that we got.
Well, Coleman, you know, it's a short and it's not a long, you know, Coleman's rise is like, you know, Coleman's been around for a while, but his transitioning rise has been like this last 8-10 years. So like mm-hmm. we won't have to really age Coleman, but we can really focus on the diversity of this theater. This specter of the theater who then is able to manifest in all these ways once he's exposed to the world.
I love it. All right. So now if that doesn't work, what's a best adapted screenplay? This was my other idea. I think something in the best adapted screenplay world where it's like, what's something that's happened? It could be IP that already exists. It could be a sequel to something. How are we going to get ourselves a best adapted screenplay nomination?
Look, I would say that the two books that I would ever want to adapt into a screenplay, and this is going to sound random, but they are a kid's book called Maniac McGee.
Maniac McGee. I've never heard of this. Okay, what's this?
It's about this orphan kid who's like, he's just like a kind of a gifted runner. He's this orphan kid and he ends up, it's really just about him trying to find his place. And he finds himself caught between the east side and the west side of this town. And like the west side is the white side and the east side is the black side. He's a young white kid, orphan. And, you know, he's living at kind of like a local band shell at a baseball park. And there's kind of like the groundskeeper takes care of him for a little while till he dies in the winter. And then the kid's living at the zoo until a young girl finds him. So then she takes him home. So he starts living with the Jackson family, this black girl and her family on the east side. And like people are treating them weird because they got this white kid staying with them. And he strikes up this rivalry / friendship with like one of the black athletes in the town called Mars Bar Jackson. Uh-huh. And like, you know, so like, and they race each other, but he beats Mars Bar. So they get into a fight. So he runs out of the town. He ends up in the west side. And then he's with like a family. So it's just like, it's a very interesting story about a young kids, but also about social dynamics. And it's just like one of my favorite books.
You absolutely should produce this regardless of this game and regardless of getting the Oscar. You should produce this.
Newbery award-winning book.
Hey, now. All right. And you said, and there's another one too. You said Manny McGee. And what was the other one?
The other one is called Alana, The First Adventure by Tamora Pierce. And it's a fantasy book about a young woman and her twin brother. And she is being sent off to, you know, like the convent to learn how to become a lady. And he's going to be sent off to become a knight. But he wants to be a wizard and she wants to become a knight. So on the road, they cut their hair so nobody can tell them apart. Uh-huh. And she gets taken to the castle. She disguises herself as a boy and trains as a squire. And he ends up going to the monastery to become a sorcerer.
And this integrates beautifully into our Schoolhouse Rock explanation of gender. So it's just like all becomes one piece of art when we put it all together.
There we are.
I love it. I think you should make both of these things, all three of the things. Make the Coleman Domingo thing too. I think it sounds like...
We did come up with some very good ideas, my friend.
That was 5 minutes of pitch session. I'm just saying, like, if you're this close, you got the E, the G, and the T. We just need an O nom. That's all we need. And then you got nom. That's pretty good. I just want to wrap up in terms of, you know, in the past couple of years, of course, the business has gone through so much, and now we discover your producing is rising above your acting, which of course makes sense in the past couple of years. But where do you see this crazy business going? Where do you see the next 5 years of you know, what has shifted and what maybe will continue to shift in the next, you know, 5-10 years?
I really don't know. You know, I think that the economics will really determine where the business goes. And I think that that'll be the economics of the country, our global economics. Because particularly with theater, you know, because theater is so expensive to make. And the more it is, the more expensive it is to make theater, the fewer risks producers are willing to take, the harder it is for diversified works to break through. And the same thing in television, you know, we've had a television and film. We've seen, you know, really the expansion of distribution platforms with streaming networks over the last couple of years. So you've seen an explosion of content, but we're starting to see a consolidation of those platforms, and also particularly in the film space, what can and cannot make it into theaters. You know, we've for a long time been in the space of big brands, big tent poles, and those being the only things that can make it into theaters. And you know, we're kind of still operating in that space. So we're gonna have to see. Hopefully, a market for smaller $3 to $5 million films will open up and will continue to maintain. And you know, and ideally, if theater can become subsidized in some way, so it's a bit more affordable. But I really don't know because the challenges that exist are not getting better right now.
Yeah, so true. All right, my last question to you is just, if there's a young artist out there who wants to be a Brandon Victor Dixon human being, what advice would you have to that person? What advice would you have to a young 17-year-old, 19-year-old, 21-year-old who's thinking, I kind of want to be Brandon when I grow up?
I would encourage them to train a lot, you know, act a lot. Make acting your number one thing you train. You know, your voice and your body, those are skills that you have to coach and develop, but what you're doing with those skills is you are acting. So the acting needs to be your primary tool, your primary resource. Always keep going. Do not be afraid to ask for help. And like I said before, lean into fear, lean into failure, lean into chaos, because they're only potential things. So it's really the fear of those things that prevent you from fully embracing experiences. And if you fully embrace experiences, you're going to succeed more than you fail. And you're going to find that whatever you gain through that, even if it doesn't end up exactly the way you want it to, you're going to be so much better on the other side and you'll have time to start again.
Such good advice. Okay, we want to give you an opportunity to plug anything that you want to plug. I know you're here specifically talking a little bit about MacGyver, the musical.
Yes, I am here to talk about MacGyver, the musical, and the album that we've recently recorded that will be available. I know you're going to provide the availability information, but MacGyver the Musical is a great new musical that has been developed and that is coming to a town near you. And one of the things that's great about MacGyver the Musical, and I don't know, you know, if people aren't familiar with the MacGyver TV show from the 80s, you really should get involved. And then they've done a remake, obviously, that played through 2021. But it's about the ingenuity of one individual. And, you know, what's really cool about the show is that, you know, we cast the lead role in MacGyver out of the audience for every performance. So before the show, there's a 10-minute audition. This is just like a thing, like, you know, there's something happened and the actor playing MacGyver can't make it to the show tonight. So someone from the audience has to play MacGyver. And three or four volunteers will act a line, sing a line, or dance something, and let the audience decide by applause who gets to be MacGyver that night. And, you know, we've had MacGyvers of all genders ranging in age from 18 to 85. So it's a really cool project. We've recorded a wonderful cast album that I hope everybody will check out. And yeah.
Super cool. Super cool.
Also, the Best Man final chapters on Peacock streaming right now. You know, I featured in that, and I hope hopefully y'all will enjoy that as well.
If people want to hear more from you, or if they just want to follow all that you're doing, where would you want them to be following you along?
You can find me at BrandonVictorDixon.com and at Brandon V. Dixon as all of my socials.
At Brandon V. Dixon. Awesome. We'll put all of that in the show notes. Brandon, thanks for the time today. It was such a joy.
No, thank you. My pleasure.
Oh, yes. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Brandon Victor Dixon. I thought he was so thoughtful and eloquent. I mean, you can really see how his intelligence impacts his art making, both as an actor and a producer. And he left lots of great nuggets for takeaways, so it's going to be hard for me to even pick just a couple. I do think there's something really interesting in going deeper about the differing approaches for film theater, where you get to rehearse for weeks but only get one or two shots at it, versus Broadway, where you get many, many shots, versus film, where you don't have as much rehearsal, and you're leading up to that filming, which is a singular thing, but you then get those multiple takes. So there's something really interesting there. We could do almost a whole episode diving deep into that, and maybe we will. One thing I did want to highlight from his definition of advocacy was just his use of the word grace. It's something you'll hear next episode for those who listen to the college episodes with Michael McElroy from Michigan. Talks about it a lot in next week, especially in sort of the EDIB conversation. And it's just a word that's been buzzing around my head for the past few years a lot. The power of grace. I think personally for me growing up non-religiously, I didn't really understand the power of that word. I would hear it kind of in the context of like graceful movement or a graceful person. And I would almost think of that as like a delicate person, or, you know, it was positive, but it was sort of there was a weakness to it. But I think understanding it in the spiritual sense of empathy and forgiveness, you know, grace to yourself and grace with others, it makes you really understand the power of that word. And I think it's a great word for artists as we embark on our necessarily messy work. I mean, to be able to lead with grace, meaning you are not insensitive to your surroundings, nor are you overly reactive, right? There's so much power in being able to say, I can go through the world gracefully. You know, it evokes listening and empathy, of course. If you're a graceful person, you have to be able to take in others, but also a strong enough sense of self to not be washed away by others. So just an interesting word to meditate on here in January of 2023, thinking about grace as we live our lives, especially as artists. And the last thing I did want to highlight from our conversation was just this really smart idea of what Brandon talked about in terms of defining success. In this case, it was about shows. You know, I asked him a super broad question about like which shows were successfully striking that balance between art and commerce, was kind of the nature of my question. And I think he very smartly threw it back to me and noting, well, you have to define what is the success for that production, for those producers and for those artists, right? You know, Lion King's incredible financial success is amazing, but it's very different than maybe the artistic success of Strange Loop, right? And they're judged on very different parameters and they might have had very different goals. And I think this is really important as artists to try to define what success looks like for each of us. I'm going to say this especially for our older artists listening. You know, often if you're still in high school, that first big hurdle is getting into college. So I'm going to ask you to write that mission statement for yourself about how you want to get into college. And then maybe beyond that, you have the dream of Broadway, or you have a sense, a more vague sense of what's coming after, but you're not totally sure what that looks like. And that really is okay. Still fine if you have a better sense of that early on, but okay if you don't at 17, 18. But then as you near graduation from college,
The more specific that definition of success looks like to you will be a helpful guide for you as you then meet with industry people. And like we talked about with Grace, it'll help you not get washed away in what they define success as, right? Because I think, you know, as you're meeting with industry people, it will kind of auto revert to making as much money as humanly possible, right? If you don't have a different definition of success, it's going to mean financial success for the most part. But I think maybe most importantly for our 24 to 30 year old listeners, there's something really important in redefining success for yourself at 27 and then at 33 and then at 38 or whatever, right? Or for our 50 year old listeners, right? It will inevitably change, right? And there's power in allowing the definition of success to change, or you know, as Krista Rodriguez put it, the dream to expand. But you do still want to have some control of the steering wheel, right? You're not totally just letting it change into what it wants, it might change into. You're able to actually listen to yourself and go, okay, right now at 33, what do I want? And what do I want to be putting my time, my energy, you know, my resources into, right? Redefining what that success is for yourself, it'll help you consciously invest in what you want your career to be, and will help, you know, avoid your career feeling like something that's happening to you and will be a little more like something that you're actively making happen. Well, that is another fantastic episode of Mapping the College Audition, if I do say so myself. Please, for the love of everything holy, have the grace to leave us a 5-star rating and review in your podcast platform of your choice. You can also DM us with your Oscar-nominatable ideas to @MappingTheCollegeAudition and or follow MTCA on all of our social platforms, which will be found in our show notes, where you'll also find a link to our website to help with any individual college audition preparation. To my young artists out there mapping their journeys, how many of you actually know what Schoolhouse Rock is? Have I suddenly become old? I'll see you next week.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.